I'm Linda Palacio, and this is A Taste of the Past, where we will introduce you to some interesting people and curious facts about cooking in history, and you're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Today, our sponsor is Dixon's Farm Stand Meats in Chelsea Market, New York City. Yes, we're all saying yay! Dixon's is just great meat from small, sustainable farms, from butchers who know what they're doing, and I encourage people who live in New York City to go visit because now they're serving lunch as well. Gabe Ross is making wonderful sandwiches and great sausages and yummy foods. And the meat, any cut you want, just go in and ask. Adam Tiberio is their butcher. He will fix up anything you want. But they also have just regular great cuts and just an all-around good butcher shop. Today we have two really terrific guests on our show, Peter Kaminsky and Donna Gelb. Peter Kaminsky has written several books with famous chefs, and Peter in his own right is famous, and he's been published in New York Magazine, Food and Wine Magazine, Condé Nast Traveler, the New York Times. He was New York Magazine's underground gourmet for many years, too. Peter's book, Pig Perfect, is a wonderful book. It sort of traces the history of pigs and hams and has wonderful recipes. And his most recent book is what we're really going to focus on today. Well, not the book, but actually the cooking. And it's called Seven Fires: Grilling the Argentine Way, which he wrote with chef and restaurateur Frances Melman. And Donna Gelb is here, too. Donna is a food writer and a recipe tester, and she adapted the recipes from the Argentine grilling methods for American kitchens. And she also worked on Pig Perfect recipes as well. So welcome to both of you on this snowy day.
Great to be here.
As we say, snowy day, a big chunk of snow just fell from the roof. You could be listening to this in June, whenever you happen to log on to heritageradionetwork.com. But today we are live and it is snowy, snowy February day. Cooking, seven fires, cooking and grilling, basically fire. I mean, that's fire. Cooking with fire is what separates us from the beast, all right? And I mean, cooking with fire and barbecue grilling, people usually just think of, you know, the quick charring of the hot dogs, hamburgers, and steaks. But in this book, it's just amazing because you describe so many different ways of cooking, so many different fires, and I want you to take us there with you. What really are the seven fires? Well, let's backtrack. You went to Argentina. What made you go to Argentina? How did this book come about?
Well, my other life, not totally separate from food writing, is I've written about fishing and hunting forever.
Sorry, I forgot those. Fisherman.
No, that's okay, but it relates to this. I mean, I wrote the Outdoors column in The Time for 20 years, and it still occasionally appears, although the sports section has got a little slimmer. But Argentina has wonderful, wonderful trout fishing, and I used to go down there trout fishing a lot. And about 15 years ago, Dana Cowan, who's the editor of Food and Wine, they had this wonderful shoot they'd done with Frances Malman, a very stylish guy who's got this great retreat up on an island in the very wilds of Patagonia, and they wanted me to write the story because I speak Spanish.
Oh, well, that's
so
convenient.
So I called Frances up, and he speaks better English than most of us, so that went out the window. But we became great friends. Over the years, we've had cookouts, you know, in the mountains in Patagonia, and his family's come to my house for Christmas, and we've gone to his island for Easter. So I think he's a wonderful chef, and beyond
quite
that,
a reputation.
I mean, as
a traditional French cooking as well. I mean,
well, that's the thing about Francis. He's a guy with tremendous talent and insane amount of taste, both visually and gastronomically. And as a young man, he worked for Bocuse, he worked for Trousselier, he worked, did he work for Marchese? He worked at Pinciori outside in Florence. So he worked at some of the great Michelin-starred restaurants. And he's this dashing fellow, and he came back and had a TV career in Argentina. And as he said, I was, I being Francis, making a lot of money cooking French food for rich Argentines, and I got bored. So in 1995, the International Academy of Gastronomy invited him to cook a meal in some Schloss in Germany. And they wanted it South American. And he said, I'm going to do a meal, every course centered on the potato. And he sent his second in command up to Peru to grab 1,000 pounds of potatoes, which they smuggled in their luggage to Germany, which always, you know, guys checking for drugs at the border, and they've got, you know, potatoes in their underwear.
Checking for potatoes.
Yeah. So he had this tremendous success there. It's still written
about.
Wait,
is this a story where his table decorations were
potatoes
as well?
So he goes into the very fancy place where these very fancy gastronomers are going to be, and the very fancy maitre d' shows him the silver that's available and the dinnerware and the plates, and says, and what would you like, you know, for decorations for your vases and, you know, candelabras and whatever? And he said, dirt. And they said, do you mean you'd like dirt in these silver things? He said, no, just dirt on the table. And this is very Francis. It's very, you've got all this elegant setting, and then dirt down the middle of the table, and in that dirt, potatoes, artfully arranged, beautifully laid out dirt, but dirt. And I guess that's what Francis is about, this mixture of the sacred and the profane and just about everything he does. So that's how we became friends. The result of that experience in Germany was he decided, I'm going to start cooking the way, you know, Argentines, and that's the gauchos and the Indians and the Creoles, criollos, have always cooked.
Well, that's what I found to be very interesting is that, first of all, Argentina is a huge country, right? The eighth largest country in the world. And tell me a little bit about, well, you just did mention the Indians, but a lot of people don't know what the cultural influences are. Who are the native Argentinians?
Well, it's got Indian heritage. Although they did almost as good a job as we North Americans did in getting rid of them, and in not the nicest of ways. But it has a Spanish heritage, and it also has a lot of Italians. The English did a lot there in wheat exporting and agriculture, so there's a big British heritage, and a lot of their schooling for the upper class is still in English. So I sort of say Argentina has all the advantages of an Italian government and a British labor movement.
Well, and certainly the Spanish influence kind of is what comes to people's minds, you know, and you know, initially it's the stronger one that has held out. Right?
Well, I don't know. Donna, you think it's very Italian
it's
as well?
Italian. I think
culinarily?
Italian, yeah. And also there's German a lot of German heritage there,
there's
too.
There's German, there's Welsh.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say it is Spanish and Italian. It's Mediterranean.
And the Indians, I mean, they preserved, I mean, I think of the gauchos, of course, the cowboys and the ranches, the wonderful ranches out there. So tell me about the cooking. Is that preserved ways, this fire, cooking with fire, are these preserved ways from the old ranchers or from the Indians? What?
A little bit of both. I mean, we can talk about the different things, the ways of fire. It's not strictly barbecuing as we certainly in the Northeast know it, which means firing up the grill and putting something over direct heat. Although that is one of the methods they love to use, they use many others. Driving over here, I was thinking that there's all these kinds of fires, but it's like what Thomas Keller says, it gets down to time and temperature. You understand where the heat is coming from and how long your food needs to be exposed to it, that determines how you utilize the fire for the ingredients.
Well, I really want to get into all these different types of fires. I mean, the book is called Seven Fires, so I would love to have you both talk about the different kinds of fires, and we'll describe that. So why don't we take a little break now, and when we come back, we'll talk about the seven fires. Taste of the Past, talking about Seven Fires with Peter Kaminsky and Donna Gelb. All right, we said we were going to describe these seven fires. Let's talk about it. What are the seven fires?
Well, we'll start with the one that was most familiar to North Americans, which would be Parrilla, or as they say in Argentina, Parrilla. That's simply cooking directly over coals, on a grate. Then
original barbecue.
Then they're
grilling over a grate.
Right.
Then they're very fond of the chapa. And a chapa, literally is a piece of tin or, sheet metal. And that's still widely used. It's set over some supports and that's set over a fire. So you have a hot surface that you're cooking on, a griddle or a skillet.
Mm-hmm.
Basically is what it is. And we use a thick piece of cast iron to duplicate that. Lodge makes a wonderful one. It's a great, I'd say Francis uses that technique more than any other. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't you, Donna?
Absolutely. It's like a plancha.
I was going to say, is this a la plancha?
It's a plancha.
It is, exactly. Uh-huh. There's that. Then there is rescoldo, which if you've ever put your potatoes in the fireplace, in the cinders, they cook a lot of things like that. That's adapted from the gauchos, who would make their breakfast fire, have their galleta, their, hardtack, and some mate, which is an herbal beverage. They'd go off cow punching, and they'd have the breakfast fire still there. So they'd put some vegetables, some whole pumpkins and peppers and onions in the embers, and they came back. It was cooked.
Well, that was the one that caught my attention the most in the photo. The photographs in this book are absolutely spectacular, just beautiful, and you get the feeling that you are sitting outside by a fire and seeing all those vegetables actually buried in the ashes like that. I mean, with a scoop of ashes on top of them too, not just nestled in there, but I mean completely covered. That looks like what a wonderful way to bake. That's great.
It's great.
Which one did you like the best of the rescoldos?
Of the rescoldos, I loved the whole Andean pumpkin.
Yeah.
Where you take they have a particular, I guess it's like a calabaza we would have here, mm-hmm. and a 3-4 pound pumpkin, whatever size you've got, and you just bury it straight in the coals while you're cooking whatever else you're doing, a whole lamb or whatever else may be going on. And it takes not that long because it's completely buried, and maybe an hour or so.
Direct heat, too.
it's direct heat, and it's completely buried from all sides in the embers. And at a certain point, you stick something in. If it's tender, it's done. And of course, for the book, as far as it, adapting the recipes, we would have our digital wire probe thermometer, so I could say that the pumpkin had, when it's this temperature, it would be
done. And depending on the redness of your coals or the grayness of your coals.
and the weather. Yeah. So, but the point is, then you split it in half, scoop out the seeds, and toss in some fresh arugula and goat cheese and a vinaigrette, and you serve it in, you scoop the flesh out and you toss it together and serve it as a salad in the halves of the pumpkin.
Oh, how wonderful. Yeah. That's definitely something you can, I mean, I'm going to dig a pit and
absolutely.
Do that this summer.
You can also do, I mean, speaking of adapting, you can just cook a pumpkin in your oven or a squash and, you know, you can do that in the house.
Not as much fun as the air.
Well,
no, but yes, as far as adapting it for an indoor alternative, yes,
and
I
it
see
still
the point.
Looks good on the table. So.
Yeah, that's true. Well, you mentioned while the lamb is roasting, so that was also the one that
asador, which
yes.
is something. It's a way of cooking lamb on a cross that the Spaniards adapted from the Arabs.
Right.
And in southern France, they cook that way as well. And like a lot of this fire stuff, it's pretty ingenious, low-tech, but simple. And you can adjust heat. People don't... They think you make a fire, and then you have no control over the heat. And that's not true. You can move your ingredients closer or further. You can move the... embers further away, the heat source. So, for example, this is just a cross, but then you can lean it towards the fire or away from the fire. 3 or 4 hours into it with a whole lamb, which is really the thing they love to do the most in Argentina. You surround it with embers, say a circle about 2.5 feet across, and that will crisp the skin on the bottom. So that's a way that they love. What's our little list here?
Infiernillo,
which means little hell.
Infiernillo.
This is classic Francis. When he was a young man, he did a television show. This is back in 1982. He was a kid. He was up in the northern province of Salta in Argentina. Has a big Canary Island heritage. And there's a lot of Incas who still live there. There are Incas who live all over the northern, central and northern part of South America. They still speak Quechua, the ancient language. And these people would cook. They would make a fire. They would have a big flat stone supported on top of that fire. They would put their ingredients on the stone. Then they would put on the four corners of the stone other rocks and put another big flat rock on top and make a fire on top. So you'd have a fire sandwich, essentially.
Great.
And it makes very even high heat. And Francis just loved that. Now he travels around with like two cast iron coffee tables that he stacks.
It's a heavy piece of luggage.
It is a great way to cook. It's a great way to cook.
Well, then we have the snow keeps plopping down.
It sounds like bodies falling off.
If you hear a thump, those are chunks of snow falling off our roof. Actually, our garden, there's a garden upstairs, up above here. It's not too active right now, but it's the garden for Roberta's restaurant. Well, and that brings me to the horno de, what is it? Horno de barro?
Horno.
Horno.
Silent H.
Horno
de barro.
Horno de barro.
A wood oven. You know it as a pizza oven.
Yeah, because here at Roberta's, we've got one. Just when you walk in the door there, Roberta's restaurant is a great pizza oven.
And...
Clay outside and wood fire. And
yeah.
So it's like the old bread making ovens?
Yes. And it's in the north of Argentina, it's called an empanada oven. You'll see people have those about as commonly as we have backyard grills. I mean, people love to cook that way in Argentina. it takes the heat out of the house, which is nice. Right. And they will roast things, it's not just a bread oven, they'll roast pigs and lamb in it. Francis really likes to get the temperature up and cook at 1,000 degrees for a short amount of time. He'll do his vegetables that way. So they get this nice charred, but not bitter, carbonized crust on it, but they're still succulent inside. And it's does whole fish that way. It's a wonderful way to cook.
Well, now, Donna, I mean, how was that for you, I mean, to get over the fact that something wasn't burned?
First of all, just to try to, it's impossible in a home kitchen, in a home oven, even with a Viking or professional stove, to get the temperature that high. But one thing that Francis does do is cook in what he calls iron boxes, which are cast iron, rectangular. They look like roasting pans, but they have a lid on them. He
They're Brazilian,
basically. And so for that was another method, the iron box. So this is also in the book. So what I would do for those recipes is get my oven really hot, preheat a cast iron. I did everything on Lodge, and I mean I already had them for like 20 years. Mm-hmm. These Lodge pans and
older
Dutch
better.
Ovens. Yeah. So I would just put a Dutch oven inside, and also preheat the lid also in the hot oven just for a long, you know, as long as I could, you mm-hmm. know, well, you know, like half an hour, 45 minutes. And then put the vegetables and fish into the hot pan and put it right back in the oven and with the top on, and it would just cook in 3 minutes.
Wow.
With that. I mean, it was just amazing.
But I'm you there. Got it. That's it. I'm doing it.
And then the idea is well protected, with your arms well protected, you bring it out to the table and take the lid off at the table so that the aromas come out.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, so. I know Francis, I was reading a part of the introduction, and Francis described, or you, one of the, Peter, the contrast between, like, the outside is so charred and the inside is still very undercooked, almost, but sweet. So it's that charredness, bitterness of the char, and then the sweetness.
Well, it's tender.
He says he doesn't like harmony in cooking. He likes dissonance. That's
as long as it goes together, right?
Well, but you need to have an artist, you know, or you have to have an instinct for what, you know, will match up that way.
That's right.
But he doesn't like harmonious blended flavors. He likes really bold, dissonant chords, if you will.
Well, one of the last methods of the fires that we haven't talked about yet, and that is caldero. Is that kettle? Is that
it's a cauldron.
It's a cauldron.
Right. Oh,
okay.
Uh-huh. But you can do many different things in it. You can deep fry empanadas in it.
A pot-au-feu?
A pot-au-feu. Francis has a cauldron. Didn't he have a hundred, that he would serve 100 people out of on his ranch?
Wow.
And I've seen that in America. I did a book with John Madden, football coach, mm-hmm. about tailgating. And he had this friend who was a Basque sheep rancher, and he brought a cauldron like Francis's. It did about 100 gallons.
Yeah. Well, I've seen those big cauldrons, and they have them from Thailand and things too for sugar, for melting sugar. Mm-hmm. But now people use them as fire pits rather than the cauldron itself, which is a shame.
But you don't need a 100-gallon cauldron to make these.
A Dutch oven will be fine.
Yeah, a regular, you know,
a five quart will do.
A cast iron pot that you move closer or further to the flame, or put on top of the flame, mm-hmm. on top of the grate, you know, will work just fine.
Mm-hmm. Well, in colonial kitchens, you know, the cast iron kettles,
exactly.
They are on rods that,
exactly.
you know, the cooks would move in the rod, you know, closer into the fire rod, just as you described. So things didn't change a whole lot. That's mm-hmm. great. That's great to hear. Donna, you talked about adapting things to the indoor, you know, indoor recipes. What, in your opinion, was the most challenging thing to have to adapt or to try to bring to the American kitchen?
Well,
one of them.
Well, one thing that I was afraid of how I was going to manage to do was the sun-dried tomatoes, because there, down there, they slice plum tomatoes on a big meat slicer, because you don't want to get them too juicy. You don't want them to fall apart. They need to be really crisp. And then they put them on great big tin metal sheets on a rooftop in the sun. So I wasn't quite sure how I was going to do that in Manhattan. But it turned out that I could very easily slice the tomatoes on a Ben Reiner, and I just put them on baking sheets on my radiator cover. It was January, and they dried in 3 days, and they were gorgeous. They looked exactly like the ones there. They look like little jewels. You can see right through them.
Oh my goodness!
And they're very delicate, and you keep them in olive oil, so they glisten. That you just take a few out You keep them in the fridge, and they glisten. They're just gorgeous, and you just toss them in salads, and people wonder, what is that? And it's so that
terrific,
you know,
little treat.
Everything was easy. I can't really think of anything.
Yeah, that's the thing we've heard in this book that, you know, I mean, I've done a lot of cookbooks. You know, the combination of Francis and Donna, it's the first time I've ever had one where no one's come back and said a recipe didn't work.
Hmm.
And, you know, some really demanding, you know, savvy, high-end people, you know, on the skill level have tried a lot of these recipes. And, you know, they work. They just work for them.
Oh, that's...
One thing we would not be able to adapt very well would be the curanto, which is the pit cooking, which
we did.
In a wheelbarrow. You did in a wheelbarrow.
See, the Tehuelche Indians who live in the southwest of Patagonia, it's pit cooking. It's, mm-hmm. Like Hawaiian cooking, like Yucatecan cooking. And they have their curanto, which is a fire and then rocks and wrapped and buried and then taken out later. And for what we did was we made one, we made a real one. And then, and it looked like we were digging a grave.
It was next to the graveyard, actually. So it was a 20-foot long one.
And then we made one with a wheelbarrow. And that's a really cool thing to do. Don't you plan on wheeling the wheelbarrow anytime soon after that.
It stays hot for a long time.
Well, no, the rubber, gets, on the one wheel doesn't remain that function.
An old wheelbarrow, preferably not wooden.
But it's a cool thing to keep for,
do it in
a
your
family
garden.
Meal. Right. Exactly.
Why not? Well, I mean, first of all, I thought of all this fire cooking and all these different methods of using fire. And then in Argentina, because, we hear of the Argentinian beef and all the cowboys and the ranchers, and they must have some incredible meats that you did over there.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's... it's funny. We've had some Argentine chefs up here to work with us to try and make sure we were doing the recipes right, in North America.
Uh-huh.
And we had an asado one day, and one chef was saying, there's no taste to the beef, which isn't, I don't 100% agree there's no taste to the beef, but I do find, grass-fed beef, which is all they have in Argentina, and grass-fed lamb, to be much more flavorful. It just has deeper, more nuanced flavor. No question
about
it.
We're trying to get there. We're trying.
And the fat is one thing that really stood out for me is the fat of the beef that they use down there. We were also in Uruguay a lot. How yellow it is. And it's almost like a whole different kind of animal. I mean, it's just...
That's one of the great, cooking is about sounds too, and one of my fondest memories is images in Argentina is you're fishing, and it's time for lunch and a siesta, so you sort of make a fire, and you can cook very quickly if you put your grill up high.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to wait for the coals to die down,
right.
And you stick a big. They love their cross-cut short ribs down there, and freshly killed piece of beef. And you put it on there, and you just sort of hear it go, while you're drinking your wine.
Sizzling and the fire.
And it really sets you up to have
and
a
the
nice
smell,
meal.
And the smell.
And
the smell
nap.
Of the fire itself
is
so wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, Donna, I know that you are going to be giving some grilling classes this summer in France at a mutual friend of ours at her home.
Yes, Anne Ravel.
Yes,
her website is Saveur Languedoc, and she gives culinary tours, and she has a little cooking school there in this beautiful old country house.
So
and
you're going to give the Argentinian, Argentine? I don't say Argentine.
We're going to do a kind of an Argentina meets Languedoc thing. What they grill over in Languedoc, is old vines, vieilles souches, which are the vines that are no longer and it's a huge wine country there, so they're always turning over vines, and when they stop producing as much as they'd like to, and they use them to grill over, and this is what what we're going to do there, and I'm going to take some of the recipes from the book, and we're going to also do traditional Languedoc recipes.
So this will be a five-day grilling course?
There's a three-day and a five-day, both in June.
I will get this up on the website for the radio, so those who are listening, you can check that out and hear what that website is. How long did you... So you were in Uruguay for a while, researching the book, because I know Francis says he did a lot of cooking there. How long total did you spend over there? And did you stretch it out so that you had a little extra vacation time?
Yeah. I mean, why not?
Absolutely. Right. And Francis has this wonderful little hotel that we were staying in, too, in Garçon.
Yeah, it's not like you were camping in the wilds.
No, it's a wonderful hotel. People come from all over the world. I was there twice over the course of the book, 3 weeks each time, I think. And you did a couple more trips.
Yeah, yeah. Plus, we went up into the mountains. To his little island retreat on a lake. So I spent, and I try and get there every year at least once to fish. I'm going down, God willing, in a couple of weeks to Tierra del Fuego at the very end of the world to fish for sea trout for a while. So I'll probably see Francis.
And which one of the seven fires will you use to cook your fish?
Well, you're not supposed to cook them there, but sometimes I get a food writer's pass. So we'll see what the day's like.
Yeah, well, it is just, again, a beautiful book. And the recipes all are so wonderfully enticing. And it's not just meat. It's everything. Pastries, too.
Desserts. Yeah. Fruit, grilled oranges.
Yeah, that one's a big hit.
With rosemary, and you serve it with yogurt and mint.
Yeah, people really love that. I mean, I've gotten a lot of response on that recipe. It's just oranges and brown sugar, and you sort of burn it on the grill. Mm. And by the time the sugar burns, the oranges have started to cook through, various stages of doneness, and it's got rosemary embedded in the sugar, and that kind of burns and aromatizes it. And then, as Donna was saying, with some yogurt or some mascarpone or creme fraiche, it's...
Oh,
fabulous.
I can taste it. Yeah, that sounds
That's a
wonderful.
Smoky one. You got to do that one outside.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, the sugar. Yeah, the sugar. Yeah.
And the burning sugar has to be outside.
All right. Well, I just, I can't wait for summertime because we can't dig a pit in the snow and cook, but I can't wait for summertime and try some of these recipes by fire. The lamb, the asado, I did have a true Argentinian do that for us in Hempstead Park in Long Island, believe it or not, years ago in the 70s. And I can't wait to try it again because it was probably the most tasty grilled lamb dish I have ever had.
It's a fun day in asado.
Yeah, and well, that's just it. It's a whole fun experience, too. It's not just going to the kitchen and toiling away and cooking dinner. I mean, it's a whole entertainment process, right? I mean, it's just you sit around the fire, you talk, you watch the food.
Well, Don and I did one in my backyard in Cobble Hill, Brooklyn. And told friends and neighbors to stop in, and they said, "Oh, we've got a lot on the on the calendar today, but yeah, we'll come in, we'll have a bite, maybe a glass of wine, then we'll leave." Nobody left. It just started out as four people, and ended up as 30, and 4 hours later, all the meat was gone, huge quantities of wine, and it's just a very convivial
that's
way.
That's the sign of a success. That's indeed a sign of success, right? Well, I just want to thank you both so much for coming out on this snowy day and sharing your stories about the book and your experience in Argentina with Francis Malman. Again, the book is called Seven Fires, Grilling the Argentine Way. And you've been listening to A Taste of the Past. I'm Linda Palacio. We'd like to thank our sponsor, Dixon's Farm Stand Meats, and our engineer, Nat Wiener, for filling in and doing a yeoman's job, even though he's down with the flu. And we hope you'll tune in again to A Taste of the Past.